Just invite you, if you haven't yet, just allow your eyes to close, or if not close, maybe just gaze downward in a soft focus. Just allow those words to wash over you, to dwell within you. I am so blessed. I am so grateful. Allowing the stillness and the quiet of this moment to just come to your awareness. Maybe paying attention to your breathing, the sensation of breathing in and breathing out, the sensation of sitting in the chair with your feet on the floor. All of this is just coming to this present moment. And maybe allowing your awareness to drop within. And just notice your thoughts and notice your feelings relative to blessings. Maybe noticing if there's any resistance or sense of defending this present moment. And considering what it would be like to not defend this moment, but can I open and be in this moment just as it is, accepting life on life's terms. James Finley has said, God is always at rest in us. Maybe reflect, how am I at rest with God? And to do it not with judgment or criticism or trying to fix or change anything, but just noticing with curiosity and kindness and an open mind. And then maybe coming back to the words of that song, I am blessed, I am grateful. Just notice how that lives in you right now in this moment. And then gently, quietly, just allowing your awareness to come back to the room, the people around you, the sights, the sounds, the smells. And as you're ready, gently opening your eyes. Thank you, Julie, Unity Singers. I just noticed in myself just a sense of softening and grounding in my just body, just letting those words soak, and it's good. I just want to take a minute and just tag on to Dennis's acknowledgement of the search team, transition team, welcome team. That's just all made me feel so welcome here at my new home in Coeur d'Alene at this church. I showed up here on Wednesday with a car, with a desk and some books in it, and started making my way into the little corner office there, and it just really felt good to be established and feel more established here. I've had a chance to meet some people here throughout the week. Wednesday, there was, I think it was it God and Coffee? Is that what it was? I just had a chance to share stories, you know, and I think that's what I'm really, really looking forward to in the days and weeks to come, is just meeting and sharing stories of your life. What's, you know, where are you? What brought you here? Where are you wanting to go? And I just, it's going to be wonderful. The series of messages that I've been offering over the last couple of weeks, and I'm going to continue offering in the weeks to come here, is a little series on finding love in fill in the blank. And so, and it's really rooted in a desire to want to lean into our mission, which is living love and uplifting lives. Life is changing a lot at warp speed. One thing that doesn't change is the mission to live love and uplift lives. And so my intention and hope is that as we look at love, finding love in these different areas of life, that it will help you anchor into that value in your life, and then maybe help you consider how you want to engage and connect with this community if you're not already engaged and connected, or maybe you want to just keep doing it or whatever. And so I really hope that that's, you know, what happens. And then as that happens, we can celebrate that and just watch and see what happens. This little kind of mini series that we're in, Finding Love in Religion, is one, though, that's personal to me. And that is because I'm aware that word religion is one that's really loaded and has a lot of history. And we've talked about this before, how some of us have had some really hurtful, painful religious background. And so, you know, the reason why it's personal for me is I have been both on the giving and receiving end of that abuse and trauma. And when I use the word abuse, I think of abuse as anything that denies another person's personhood or their humanity or their identity, anything that overruns that, anything that denies that, anything that seeks to squash or suppress that, I think of as abuse. And so that's what I mean when I use the word religious abuse. And then trauma is the effect of that abuse. And so when I think of trauma, especially religious and spiritual trauma, it's not just what happened, what was said or what was done, but it's how the body, how the mind and the heart responds to that hurt and to that pain. And usually there's some kind of separation, some kind of disassociation, some kind of denial, something that gets exiled. And so that's the trauma. Now the good news is, as we here aspire to be a community of love and uplift lives, when we can just gently, with permission and consent, allow the light of love and compassion to shine on those hurt areas, that's how we heal. And by healing, it's not about eradicating or forgetting or anything like that. No, those stories are a part of who we are. There's going to be a song that's going to be sung after this that talks about healing in a holy, holy way. And it really is about being holy. And oftentimes, again, holy is one of those religious words that thinks of as, you know, we think of as being moral. But I really think the essence of the word holy, H-O-L-Y, is to be whole, E-W-H-O-L-Y. That is our whole self, our whole person, our whole experience can be present in love and enjoy the pleasant things and some of the unpleasant things. So that's why I'm spending some time sharing with you about this. And my hope is I share with you how I have both been on the giving end and the receiving end of religious abuse and trauma, that may help you navigate some of yours. Now, if you've been here and you haven't had any religious trauma in your life or whatever, okay, you know, you can search Amazon or Facebook or Instagram or whatever, and no offense, no offense taken, okay? that's totally okay. But the thing is this: as I was a pastor in the evangelical Christian tradition for 28 years, I didn't wake up in the morning and think, "Gee, how can I spiritually abuse and spiritually harm people?" Now, I'm not going to speak for everybody else, I'm just going to say for me, you know, and a lot of what I did came from a place of ignorance and unconsciousness. I was just doing the best I can to try to navigate my way through the world and help others navigate their way through the world. I'm very well aware today that I am still in the process of healing. And this, just being really transparent with you, you know, this role as minister is my first role back in full-time ministry in 8 years. And I'm aware of tendencies and patterns in myself that I'm just aware that I just notice kind of pop up. And I'm grateful for the community here that can help, you know, bring me back to center and bring me back to ground. But it's real easy for people like myself to hide behind the role of minister. You know, or a title to on Sunday mornings, you know, the it's not really a dialogue that happens, it's a monologue. This is a one-way conversation of me talking to you, and there's minimal interaction. I can hide behind my education and my experience and all of that. And so that's just the human dynamic of how these things go. But what I come back to is what we share together, and that is the fundamental belief in the power of love to connect, to heal, to empower and inspire. And so that's really where I am today, and that's why I feel so grateful to be sharing some of these messages with you. So before we launch into the new content today, I just want to revisit what I shared with you a little bit last week, and we're really talking about how spiritual communities start out and then evolve into religious communities that become irrelevant and irreligious. And so I just want to quickly review this image or diagram with you that I shared last week, okay? So most, if not all, spiritual communities start off with a person or group of people having some sort of a mystical experience. And a mystical experience can be anything that's hard to describe in words. We can try, but it doesn't always work. And a mystical experience can be more than just something that happens in a spiritual or religious setting. It could be listening to a concert. It could be going to a sporting event. Watching the Mariners lose last night to the Tigers, you know, was a mystical experience. Watching the Huskies beat Maryland yesterday. Was that yesterday? Yeah, they did, okay? Was a spiritual experience, you know? So sporting events, you know, being in nature. These last couple of days this week, I've had some opportunities just to walk the land and the property out here and really have a sense of gratitude for the many people that have given and invested in this land, gratitude for the land and allowing us to be here and do what we do and reshape it and form it. And it was a mystical experience. But the point is here is that there's a person or group of persons that have a mystical experience that shifts our worldview. From that mystical experience, then, doctrine is formed. Doctrine being ways that the world works, way that people work, ways that people relate to one another and to nature and the divine or the transcendent. Out of that doctrine, then, come ethics. Ethics are all about rules of engagement, agreements. Have you ever been a part of a group, you know, and they have, these are our group agreements. These are how we're going to agree to be with each other. And then oftentimes from those ethics, there is a ritual or rituals that support the ethics, that support the doctrine. Now, without a return to a mystical experience or without a return to self-awareness and consciousness, that doctrine can harden or ossify into dogmatism. This is how things always are, okay? Ethics can devolve into legalism. This is how you must be in order to be here. This is how you must not be in order to be here. The church that I was a part of early on, we couldn't listen to secular music. We couldn't drink alcohol. We couldn't go to anything more than a PG movie. PG-13 was pushing the envelope. women had to wear clothes, you know, dresses down to their knee with minimal makeup. Men had to wear ties. I mean, we look back at the church I helped start in 1995. I'll never forget the day that my colleague, who we were doing this with, came into my office one day and he said, "James," he was totally serious, "we will never have the internet at this church." Yeah, it's so funny, you know. I mean, now you go to that church today, and it's, you know, the internet. Have a liturgy here at this community of how things are done, and of course, it's always open to change. But the idea is to just remember that it's the rituals that support the experience, not the experience supporting the rituals. That's when it becomes irrelevant. Okay, so. You might say, it's easy to look back and say, "Oh, well, of course, yeah, this is all ridiculous." But there's a certain strength in dogmatism, legalism, and ritualism, and that is this: it helps identify what we're about. One of the things that I've heard about this community, just kind of talking around town, is, "Well, you guys are unity. You don't stand for anything. You believe everything that's out there, you know?" And I said, "Oh, that's curious, you know." But, you know, people think, "Oh, yeah, Unitarians, they just kind of flap with their arms in the wind and just go with the flow." And I just thought to myself, wow, there is one thing that we stand on fiercely, strongly, and that is the power of love to heal lives and build bridges and connect people together. And that, to me, doesn't feel weak or not knowing. That, to me, just seems crystal, crystal clear. But the mind wants to attach to that, you know, especially the masculine mind, you know, be strong, know what you stand for and all that. And, okay, all right, that's all well and good, but just understand the limits of it, okay? But another one I'd like to offer you is this: to discern descriptive and prescriptive experiences. Oftentimes in the mystical experience, we can read about a description of something and turn it into a prescription for the future. This happens a lot in Christian Pentecostal circles who read the book of the Acts of the Apostles. The Acts of the Apostles talk about all the signs and wonders and miracles that happened during the days of the apostles following the life of Jesus. And so, for example, there are many cases where it says that so-and-so apostle would lay their hands on somebody and they would be baptized in the Spirit and speak in tongues. So a whole movement gets built on that and saying, well, it happened there in the Bible, so if I come down and lay my hands on Julie and say just the right prayer, she's going to start speaking in tongues. And we set ourselves up with that. Charles and Myrtle Fillmore, who are the founders of Unity, one of the things we're going to talk about is finding love at Unity, where we'll take a little bit of an exploration into the history of this movement. Myrtle had a mystical, spiritual healing experience that was amazing. And Charles, among the many things that both of them did, this is not exhaustive, you know, but sought to integrate Western spirituality and Eastern spirituality, particularly Western Christian thought with Eastern Christian thought, which is really helpful because Christianity has had its beginnings in the East. Jesus was Eastern, and his primary language was Aramaic, not English. And he wasn't American. Okay. You all know that, right? Yeah. Okay. So that was really helpful. But again, what we want to discern is to read the description of that history, but be mindful to not turn it into a prescription. One of the messages that come up is we're going to be talking about finding love in prayer. What is this thing called prayer that we teach here? We believe in it. And we talk about, when we talk about prayer, we talk about it's not so much about who or what you pray to, but where you pray from. See, it's a subtle shift. When we make it about who we pray to, that's when we get all wrapped around the axle. Well, that God's not that God's not that God. That doesn't matter. What matters is the heart. That's where the healing happens and where the healing begins. But again, we have to be careful because even in this tradition, when I was an evangelical, I was taught a formula for praying by the acronym ACTS. I don't know if any of you remember that, but A is for adoration, C is for confession, T is for thanksgiving, and S is for supplication. And that was a pattern. That was very, very helpful in kind of taking this broad subject prayer and making it into something, you know, graspable. Here in this tradition, the one that I've learned through my study of New Thought is, God is, I am, I know, I am grateful, I release and let it go. again, a beautiful, helpful model, but if we're not careful, we can make it just about the head and not the heart. Jesus taught, when you pray, go to God in what? Secret. And your God in secret will reward you in secret. He said, when you pray, don't be like the people who like to stand on platforms under lights and go on and on and on and on and on uttering words, you know, okay? But know that spirit, sometimes it's like, I don't know how to pray. I don't have the words. St. Paul said, that spirit intercedes on our behalf with groanings that are too deep for words. Sometimes prayer isn't about is about saying absolutely nothing and just being present to the experience and watching and waiting and listening. So anyway, that's last week. What I want to do is to continue the discussion of this, and again, and take a little bit, even a closer, deeper look at how spiritual communities get off the path. And I call this the unconscious path of spiritual communities. This is inspired by the writing of Richard Rohr, who is a Franciscan priest whose writings really enrich and inspire me. But kind of just looking at the same thing, but through a different level, different lens, okay? The first phase, again, of a spiritual community is a movement. We've already talked about that. But that's what happens. And then if we're not conscious, that movement can shift into becoming a machine. And that's basically, when a movement happens, now we need structure. Now we need organization. We need processes. We need procedures. All of this is fitting and proper and well and good. Please don't misunderstand me in saying, oh, Reverend James doesn't believe in processes or procedures or how things are done. No, we need those to help us operate clearly. But if we're not careful, the energy can start to shift. When a spiritual movement happens, there's usually this very strong centripetal force. Any physicists in here, you know what centripetal force is? It's an outward gravitation of an object that spins to go out, to go out, to go out. And so when a new community forms, there's this force to go out, to go out. As that movement becomes more machinistic, machine-like, okay, there can be a shift in some of that external centrifugal force can then become a centripetal force inward. And more attention starts being given and more resources start being given to keeping the machine operating. If we're still not careful, that movement can now come into a monument, become a monument where most, if not all, of the centrifugal outward being a blessing and a help to the community energy now becomes inward. And it's not just a machine, but the people who are a part of it thinking, look at this bright, shiny object called a church or a gathering, you know, or whatever. And we start to idolize it. And we idolize it because we lose track of the values that started it in the first place. Now, again, it would be real easy, and I have a Catholic background, so when I think about this, I can look at the many expressions of the Catholic Church, and this is not to discredit anybody here that has Catholic background, or you may go to a Catholic church, but certainly we can see how over the years, in many, many cases, there are elements of Catholicism where it becomes this monument, you know, that we worship. The same thing can happen here. We can be proud of who we are. We can be proud of the people who've gone before. We can be proud of the people who've worked hard to establish this. But let us always keep our eyes on the spirit that spoke to them rather than all of the history that got them there. I mean, I've never met Charles or Myrtle Fillmore or Ernest Holmes in New Thought, but I'm fairly certain if their spirit were here today, they would say something to the effect of, yes, read our writings, learn from us, grow from us, or whatever, but let our writings take you to the spirit and to the divine that spoke to us, and then go do it yourself. That's the idea. We can certainly see where this also happens in the world of politics. And I'm And I'm chewing on. I've got a message on finding love in politics, and I'm not sure, you know, the timing of all that, or how that's going to work. Okay. But if you think about political movements, this certainly happens in political movements, whether you're conservative or whether you're liberal, progressive. We start becoming enamored with ourselves and who we are and what we stand for. And we miss the heart and the spirit of how things could be. And I think perhaps most disturbingly or most tragically is that we remain separated and we remain fractured, where we really can be better if we put our eyes and our hearts and our minds together. Okay, so how can we maintain a conscious path? And these, again, are just some principles that I am learning in my life. These principles start with, I would invite you to let these principles start with yourself, and then branch over into your community and on from there, okay? The first principle is this: nurture the capacity to be self-critical. Nurture the capacity to be self-critical. Start with yourself, your own beliefs. I do this all the time. Question my own beliefs. Allow others to question them. That's really, really hard. But without the ability to be self-critical, I agree with Richard Rohr, who writes that all religious movements become idolatrous. I'll offer two words. I don't know if you've heard these words, but if you want to go home saying you learned something in church today, maybe this will be them, okay? In the world of prayer and spiritual knowledge, there's what's called cataphatic knowing and apophatic knowing. Have you ever heard of that? Okay, I didn't think so. I didn't either. So let me explain it to you, okay? Cataphatic knowing is like the knowing that we get when we go to school. You know, I don't know something, and now I know it. I'm imparted information, and I gain knowledge. I gain wisdom. I gain information, okay? Apophatic knowing is about learning what you don't know. Okay? So there's I don't know what I don't know, which is, you know, just ignorance. But then apophatic knowing is I don't know what I don't know. That's one of the results of being open to being self-critical for yourself and your spiritual community. We don't know what we don't know. Now, to the mind and to the ego, that type of learning is scary, because the mind wants to know. And the mind's desire to know is a good thing. Again, we're not here to pathologize the mind. We're not here to pathologize the ego. We need our minds. We need our egos. They're good. What we want to do is grow in our capacity to know when the mind and the ego are working and be able to think beyond that. That's what in the New Testament it means by the word repent, metanoia, to think beyond, to know beyond. It's sometimes we talk about in these circles, you know, the death of the ego or killing the ego or whatever. And I don't like that word. You can't kill your ego. I've never known anybody that has successfully killed their ego, but I've known many people who've become skilled in recognizing when the ego's at work, when the ego attaches to things, and they're able to see that and acknowledge that and meet that with love and compassion and allow love to heal and grow. Okay? A second conscious path of spiritual communities is to welcome the prophetic voice. To welcome the prophetic voice. Again, I'm drawing from my Christian background, but in Jesus' day, does anybody know one of the main prophets that was alive during Jesus' day who kind of came before him? John the Baptist. Yeah, John the Baptist. A real salty character who lived out in the desert, had nothing, and I think he ate locusts and honey, you know? A fringe character. In the Hebrew scriptures, you know, what's referred to as the Old Testament, I don't like that word. You know, I just tend to think of them as the Hebrew scriptures, but prophets were these people who were kind of marginalized. And you may know some people like that in your life. okay, you know, that are prophets. When I was, I spent some time in my Christian years swimming in Pentecostal circles, and in those circles, they would be people who have a prophetic gift that come over and say, hey, I have a word of knowledge for you. I have something I want to tell you, and it's like, oh, okay, I think I want to hear this, okay? But it's a prophetic voice. The prophetic voice are those voices that live on the inside of the outside edge of the community or the organization and speak a word of correction to it. That's opposed to the priest or the minister and the pastor who live inside the community. And if they're not useful, they sit there and they have their, you know, guns pointed and they're keeping all the bad, you know, bad people out or whatever, but they're there to defend and protect the organization. The prophet is there to critique the organization and call their practices into question. That's why so many of them were ostracized. But I want to go back to something I mentioned earlier that I think is helpful for this day. There are prophets in our day today. And I think of the many ages we're living, I think we're living in an idea age. We're coming out of the technological age, and now we're living into the idea age where anybody can publish anything on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook. What are some other ones that I'm sure I'm missing? I'm so out of it, okay? You know, ideas cannot be killed. Ideas cannot be killed. You can try to kill a messenger. You may not like him, you know, but ideas cannot be killed. And the sooner that we can understand that and realize that, maybe we can allow that disruptive prophetic voice to have its way. And that's what a prophet's voice does. This is especially true in the area of spirituality and religion and politics. Spirituality is at its best when it's a critic of government, not a friend of government. Christianity really fell off the rails in the 4th century when a well-meaning Roman leader sought to end the persecution of Christians and make Christianity the official religion of the Holy Roman Empire. But what happened was religion and spirituality met power and dominion, and everything went sideways. You may be here today thinking, oh, I wish we had a more friendly government, you know, to religion and spirituality. Be careful what you wish for. That's not always the best. Persecution, hardship, and trial has this uncanny way of bringing out the best in people. When Jesus, before Jesus died, he prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane. You know what the word Gethsemane literally means? It means olive press. Olive press. So in the story, it talks about Jesus sweating blood, an imagery for, you know, agonizing in prayer. But the idea here is that to the original hearers, Gethsemane, an olive press. What happens when you crush an olive? You get olive oil. Yeah. And so the imagery here is that through the crushing of an olive comes this beautiful oil of blessing. This is the paradox. This is the mystery of life and the human experience. When we go through those crucible moments of our life, when maybe our faith or our beliefs or our worldview is disrupted and everything like that, that has the capacity to bring forth a beautiful blessing as we allow our hearts to remain open and receptive to it. So we want to welcome those prophetic voices into our life. You may be someone who has that gift, and my encouragement to you is to use it. Prophetic voices are often disruptive. And I'll just say one more thing about prophecy, because there's two dimensions to it. There's prophecy in terms of foretelling the future. I think it was at Nostradamus, you know, who was famous for, you know, predicting the future. And there's another dimension about prophecy, which is foretelling. And that is giving context and meaning to what is happening right now, okay? And so again, sometimes those messages can be disruptive. They can be unsettling. My invitation to you is to welcome your capacity to receive that and to be open to that and let love have its way. Now, the last one is probably the most important, and it's this: maintain love and connection, okay? To be prophetic, to be self-critical, is not to be rebellious, and it's not to be negative. And we see a lot of this in our society today. People who try to be disruptive, people who try to be corrective, can also be mean. unloving, and rebellious. When we can hold love and connection into prophecy, oh, there's so much good that can happen. So much good. Let me show you just a couple of examples. These are some groups. This isn't an exhaustive group, but these are a couple of groups that come to mind who operate this way. The first one is Alcoholics Anonymous, AA, okay? Their belief is that God is expressed in the group consciousness. There's not one person who claims to speak for God, says the one who's up here doing that, okay? But AA has a very conscious, intentional thing that God is expressed in the consciousness of the group. And secondly, they believe in growth by attraction, not by promotion. When's the last time you've seen a commercial for AA? When's the last time you got a postcard in the mail advertising something happening in AA? No, they have a belief that if something good is happening, people are just gonna naturally tell people about that. And I just thought of this, community here. You know, let's just be so good, you know, that we don't have to worry about promotion or anything like that. People just come because it's good and the word just spreads. Okay? A second group that, and again, this list is not exhaustive. I'd love to hear other examples if you have one, but the Quakers, known as the Religious Society of Friends. Here are some just characteristics of theirs. Okay, they're non-creedal. You won't find any belief or doctrinal statements about who they are. Okay? So they don't have any dogma at all. Secondly, there's a fundamental belief that they see God in everyone. And that's, again, when we have our Christ candle here, we're talking about Christ consciousness, okay? Christ, I've said this before, Christ is not Jesus' last name. Christ is the consciousness that Jesus lived and taught, okay? And Christ is just one of many names for this. Other traditions use prana, chi, true self, I'm forgetting them now, but you understand what I mean, okay? But this, again, there's something of God in everyone who's in and outside the group. Okay, a third quality, and this one is really interesting. They do voteless decisions by unity. Now, this takes a lot of time and a lot of patience, but as a group, they take the time to discern together how Spirit is leading. I find this fascinating. Now, I came from a church whose leaders, you can look it up, CanyonHillsCommunityChurch.org, governed by mostly white men. That comes from a belief that only men can be in leadership, and I don't want to go down that red rabbit trail anymore. You know, but they kind of prided themselves in operating by unity. We don't take votes, we only operate by unity. But the kind of the underside shadow of that is uniformity, the pressure to conform. So sure, you can say you're unity, but the underbelly of that is no, there's a pressure to conform and be like us. With the Quakers, there's no agenda. They're on divine time, and they can take months and years to make a decision that others think maybe to be done in days. I need more of that in my life, because my default is to operate at like Mach 3 and just doom, 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 doom. But I really admire that capacity to wait and be of one mind and one heart before doing something. And then lastly, they're non-hierarchical. You just don't find that within the Quaker society. So again, those are just a couple of examples. I just want to say this, that I love, one of the things I picked up being here in the building this week, I love the many ways that this building and facility is used for people in the community to use. I knew that, you know, but until you just actually see that and experience that, it's like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And I just look forward to seeing that grow, to see that amplify, to see that goodness magnify and that presence of good in our community grow. I just like to close with a little prayer of reflection. This is something that I have written in my Bible, and I've just remembered it. It's a Kenyan prayer, and this is just one for humble self-reflection, and in closing, I offer this to you today. From the cowardice that dare not face new truth, from the laziness that is content with half-truth, from the arrogance that thinks it knows all truth, O Spirit of Truth, deliver me. Amen. So it is.